Perspectives Not Found on Mainstream Media. Time right now is 8 a.m. and the temperature outside is minus one. Good morning, Mary Jane.
Good morning, John. It's a very lovely morning, nevertheless. And it's a very, very brisk out there and pleasant, I think. Anyway, I want to just acknowledge that on Wooden Spoons, we are located on Treaty 1 territory, the traditional land and waters of the Cree, Ojibwe, Ojibwe Cree, Dakota, and Dene people, as well as the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis homeland. We also acknowledge the Shoal Lake No. 40 First Nation and its territory for our life-giving water. And just to give an outline of what we're going to be covering this morning, we have two guests this morning for the first part of the program, and who I will introduce shortly. And for the second part of the program, I will be talking about some things relevant to this time of year, which where there are a lot of leaves, and how we can be treating our landscape with care for the environment and protection of the many insects that are disappearing from our world due to the modern landscapes. So on that note, I would love to introduce, we have two guests this morning, Marika Dewar-Narowski. She works for and is the executive director of an organization titled Manitoba Organics. Marika obtained a degree in biosystems engineering at the University of Manitoba. Having grown up in an organic grain farm in western Manitoba, Marika has a strong connection to organic farming. So today we will be discussing a number of topics concerning organically grown crops as opposed to mainstream agriculture, where the application of toxic pesticides is the norm. So this is a multifaceted subject, which is not given much attention by the mainstream media and may not be well understood by the general public. So, and we also, I understand that we're going to be joined by Kaylin Spain, who is will be telling us about the work that she is doing. So, on that note, I would like to introduce Marika and also Kaylin. Or am I having two people today? Okay, we need some volume.
Yeah, I think I only sent the link to Marika. I didn't know Kaylin was going to be on today, so yeah.
Well, maybe I'm mistaken.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think I am.
Well, morning, Mary Jane. I'm on the call, and I can hear you loud and clear if you can hear me.
We're not getting any volume.
Oh, you can't hear?
I can't hear anything, no.
Okay, because I can hear her.
Oh. I wonder if it's the...
I turned up the volume a little bit
okay.
On the...
Well, that hopefully that will work. Okay, so for starters, could you describe Manitoba Organics, Marika, which has 7 board of directors, and the type of work that you do with Manitoba Organics?
Of course, and thank you so much for having me on the show this morning. So Manitoba Organics, we like to say we're the voice for organics in the province of Manitoba. And we use that to speak on behalf of organic farmers, processors, and engaging supporters. We work to strengthen the organic sector through education, outreach, and advocacy. And our wonderful board is mostly made up of farmers within the province, but also industry members from across Manitoba. And that helps keep us grounded, not just with the farm gate and what farmers are experiencing, but other stages of the value chain and what it takes to get organic food to people's doors. As the executive director, I help coordinate projects that support organic farmers, but also farmers that might not be organic but want to implement some organic practices with tools like nutrient budgeting, cover cropping, helping with market prices through an initiative we have called Organic Grain Hub, helping integrate grazing on crop acres and making partnerships and doing a lot of public outreach so that people can understand what organic really means and why it matters.
Well, that is a very encouraging kind of thing that you're doing, because I think maybe a lot of people are starting to recognize the importance of growing organically, and it would be the better for everybody's health and for the farmer's health as well. Maybe you could identify the term organic, Marika. How would you describe organic foods as opposed to non-organic foods? And then also, what are the principles followed to ensure that a product is organic?
Yeah, of course. So at its very core, organic is about working with nature rather than trying to control it. Agriculture is a really intensive process, and often it's unnatural. We are trying to harvest food out of a landscape that often would be better off being left alone. So trying to work in harmony with our local ecosystems and habitats. Organic food comes from farms that are not using synthetic pesticides or fertilizers. They're not using any GMO seed. They're not adding growth hormones. Instead, they rely on principles of soil health, biodiversity, and ecological balance to maintain positive yields and successful crops. So the principles behind organic farming include actually four really key pillars, which is care for the environment, fairness for how food is produced, transparency for consumers, and care. And those principles are what we use every time we reevaluate what the standards are, how we're growing, and even us as an organization and how we choose to move forward. At the end of the day, organic farming is about building healthy soil, clean water, and resilient farms that can sustain the future for generations to come, not just this one.
Mm-hmm. Well, those are very good principles. And it's interesting that a lot of farmers, and it's not surprising that a lot of farmers would be wanting to move away from the mainstream agriculture, because I think a lot of people have probably suffered some ailments due to their contact with the pesticides and so on. I don't know if you know if that being the case,
yeah.
But...
Yeah, it's unfortunate, especially in rural areas. Often when they have done testing for contamination, they found that those living in rural Manitoba have so much higher levels in their blood because of where we live. And even I can theorize that myself, I'm on an organic farm now, but I am surrounded by conventional agriculture that is really input heavy right now. That's how farmers have been taught to grow, and it's really hard to buck that system and grow food in a different way.
Mm-hmm. So it certainly is something to be concerned about, having that exposure. I know that, well, I have experienced some of that, you know, in the country where there's a lot of pesticides being used. So organic certification is a guarantee that the product the public is buying is truly organic. So would you explain how the certification works and determines how a product is labeled to qualify for the designation of organic?
Yeah, so the certification is how we can trust that organic label and how much weight goes behind it. So every certified organic farm and processor in Canada follows what is the Canadian Organic Standard and is inspected by a third-party certifying body every single year. And that certification is not planned a year in advance. I usually get one day's notice that they're coming tomorrow, and they will tour my entire farm. They'll look through all your books. They will ask a lot of probing questions. They actually do a random search onto one of your crops where you have to explain every step that it's taken to guarantee that you've been following this organic standard in the way you've produced it. And it's not just me as a farm. Every step of the food value chain gets that same level of scrutiny and inspection so that we know that the truck that transported that organic grain or produce has been cleaned out and was not transporting a conventional crop with contamination left behind afterwards. And the facility it goes to is inspected, that they're putting it in an organic grain bin, that it's not going to be contaminated in the storage facility or in the store where it has to be labeled and separated, to like making granola bars where they have to show that the factory and the assembly lines are all inspected to show that there's, again, no contamination and no ability for products to cross paths, that you are getting organic food when you see that organic label. It is a lot of work, but then at the end of the day, if you were to talk to a manufacturer of, let's say, organic granola bars, they would be able to go all the way back in their records and tell you exactly what farm those seeds came from, because every single step of that value chain has been inspected.
Well, that is a pretty thorough system, and it's certainly can build confidence in the labels of organic, and so that's I think that's quite amazing. So having your storage places free from contact with pesticides is you know, something that people wouldn't even think about, I don't think. But yeah, the inspectors
it's
do.
It's a lot of work.
So yeah, it keeps you on your toes. I mean, it's not that you're going to be doing any, you're not going to try to slip in pesticides, but you don't want to inadvertently put your crops at your food at risk.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just to maintain that integrity and to be able to guarantee the public that if you see that label on a product, it means it's meeting this consistent national and international standard.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's very reassuring to know that they take that, they do painstaking, inspections.
And I think painstaking would be the right word. If you talk to any organic farmer, they would happily give you a few grumbles about the amount of labor that goes into their annual certification.
I think somebody's at the door. We're just going to let our co-host in for 1 second.
Coming.
The door was inadvertently locked by whoever left. You couldn't get back in, John. Well, that's... yeah, you're listening to Wooden Spoons on CQW 95.9 FM. And we're talking to Marika Dewar-Narosky. And it's all about organic farming and what it entails and what organic really means. So... You were just explaining how the certification works and how there's a lot of inspections that have to be done to determine that the product is labeled to qualify, that it is designated as an organic and qualifies to be called that. I understand that one of your interests and concerns is to make organic foods accessible to everyone. So would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, of course. So that's really important to me and a lot of people in the sector. Organic food shouldn't just be a luxury item that only few can afford. It should be available and choice that people can make confidently and have access to. Accessibility means supporting local markets, fair pricing, and making more connections between farmers and consumers. So trying to support shorter value chains. I think we'll talk about cost later, but with that inspection and every step of the value chain getting inspected, it means that some costs can be added to the process of guaranteeing that this food is organic. And one way to shorten that chain is to get your food directly from farms as close as you can and supporting local farmers. So part of our work at Match Organics is to help build those supply chain connections, whether that's linking a farm to a small bakery or a mill that can mill their own wheat and then can be buying and selling a product that was produced entirely here in Manitoba, to trying to help consumers find some of the farms that are direct marketing and selling food off of their farm. We're really lucky here in Manitoba to have one of the very few grain CSAs in North America that is an organic CSA. So you can buy in to a share and get a bunch of organic cereals grown right here in Manitoba. And that is one way of really reducing the cost of organic and making it accessible, that people can have corn and beans and oats and oatmeal and all of these products from our backyards.
We buy, at Mary Jane's Cooking School, we purchase products from the Rooks on top of the farm, on top of the hill farm.
Yep.
You might be familiar with them. And they produce all types of flours and different grain products, oatmeal and millet and flax seeds and all sorts of things. And and they deliver to us too. They come and they deliver to the city and to different stores, yep, that carry them. So, in the mainstream agriculture, crops are grown with the use of herbicides and also contain glyphosate, which is inserted into the plant and is meant to kill insects. So Monsanto, which is now Bayer, has taken over agriculture, and has taken over from Monsanto. In the past, farmers could save their seeds, but this is not allowed because Monsanto, now Bayer, claims the right to their seeds. A number of years ago, the University of Winnipeg offered a film festival on a yearly basis, which was initiated by an activist in the United Church. This was really a wonderful time. That just every year we used to have a film festival. And I recall there's a whole variety of different films being shown. And I recall seeing a film about the introduction of Monsanto seeds through corporate interests in India. So basically, previous to that, Indian farmers would save their seeds. And their seeds had dormant genes. And however, they would kick in when needed. So all of these, a lot of seeds have, well, plants have dormant genes for certain occasions, when there's a drought or something like that. So if the plant has a dormant gene and suddenly there's a drought, then this helps the plant develop resistance and survive under very challenging circumstances. So when drought occurred in India, and this is what happened, Indian farmers lost their crops, and many men, out of shame, committed suicide by drinking Monsanto's pesticide. Now, this led to a huge number of women without husbands becoming destitute. Had it not been for this documentary, no one would have even been aware of the devastation caused by Monsanto seeds, which is basically foisted on the farmers by corporate interests and corrupt government officials. And so one person who opposed and fought Monsanto and is still there and still a leader is Vandana Shiva, an Indian scientist who promoted organic agriculture and fought against corrupt officials who were beholden to Monsanto. Are you familiar with Vandana Shiva?
I actually looked up the story with Vandana Shiva in preparation of this interview, because you had shared that as an example that we might talk about, and I wasn't before this story. And it's interesting, as someone that works in the sector, to have another story that I didn't know about. There's sadly so many. And this example you shared on seed sovereignty is such a powerful example, and sadly not past tense. Farmers still today are fighting to be able to save and control their own seed. And organic farming, you're right to make the connection, it really values that independence and the ability to save seed, not just for economic and moral reasons, but also you talk about the genes. And if I'm able to save seed from my farm, I can save seed year after year and get varieties that are made for my landscape, that work better on my farm. But if I'm forced to buy a new seed every year, I do not have that upper edge of getting a variety that fits my system. So if it's okay for me to go on, the seed saving is a whole interview that we could do as a separate hour. It is a really big rabbit hole. And right now it's actually a live political issue in Canada. And the National Farmers Union is being really active and central in pushing back when a farmer's right is being threatened. And right now it is being threatened in Canada. Canada's laws include what something is called farmer's privilege, which is your right to reuse, select, exchange, and sell seed from your own harvest to be used as seed. This has been a longstanding tradition, and on small farms, on organic farms, on these diversified farms, this is critical to how we are farming. So right now, the federal government seed regulatory modernization process has put in legislation of Bill C-18, which threatens to narrow that privilege significantly. To give an example, one of the proposals would limit seed saving to only certain types of crops like wheat, cereals, and exclude things like vegetables and ornamentals or hybrids. So like fruit trees, for example, and not being able to cut grafts off your fruit trees and use them to grow the next stock. And this is a fine balancing act, because the reason they're doing this is not just to spite farmers, but to help with breeders' rights so that they can own more royalties for those varieties. And I think there's a balancing act to play between things like, if you've, I'm sure, had a Hascap berry. That's a beautiful berry. It comes out of the University of Saskatchewan. It has been developed there, and they do have royalties on that crop, but it is owned by a university that has been putting a lot of research into making these cultivars that farmers can grow. It's relatively accessible. And I think all farmers agree that that's not one of the breeders' rights that is infringing on their right as a farmer. So the NFU is actually really advocating right now for something called the Farmer Seed Act, which is a legal framework that would explicitly protect a farmer's right to save, reuse, exchange, and sell their seed amongst other farmers. And in organic agriculture, like I had said, seed sovereignty is foundational. Without that ability to have seed that you're saving that can adapt to your local conditions, we don't have organic varieties. The large scale agriculture is developing things like Roundup Ready canola that is better suited for more input use, when we want crops that can thrive with less. And that's only going to happen with farmer-led participatory plant breeding. So it is sadly right here today an issue in Canada of the ability to save our seeds and continue with being able to save and replant and have that kind of farmer-led participation.
Yeah, and it was, as you're speaking about the right to save seeds, there was a case, a test case, that was quite a few years ago again. I don't know if you heard of Percy Smizer. Mm-hmm. And yes. So guess what? He had a few of Monsanto's seeds in his crops. Monsanto brought him to court, charged him for pilfering their seeds. Basically, what happened, Monsanto's seeds or whatever got into his field, somehow or the other it did. And so there was a huge court case, and there was also at the University here of Winnipeg, I think it was here, or it might have been in another place, there was a big discussion on that whole thing, and Shiv Chopra was also there. He was a famous person that was at the head of Health Canada. And he was very fair, and he was very supportive of farmers and their, and the right to save seeds. But even accidentally, seeds do spread, and Monsanto's seeds spread, and mm-hmm. they should have been charged themselves instead of the other way around. Anyway, I mean, this is a terrible thing situation.
Imagine that is such an example of the repercussions of that actually are still around today. In if you want to grow organic canola for cooking oil or for any use, mm-hmm. you need to show that you have a 5-kilometer buffer from the edge of your field where no one is growing canola. And in Manitoba's landscape, that is pretty much impossible. Mm-hmm. Because of this cross-contamination, these seeds move. They if they cross-pollinate, are a dominant gene. So what basically happened is it gutted this crop from organic farmers. It is not a crop I can choose to grow anymore. There's very few farms in Canada. If you are right in the Interlake where there's water on three sides of you, mm-hmm. you might be able to get that buffer. But instead of having to have safer restrictions on the people using that seed, it fell onto organic farmers that no longer can grow organic non-GMO canola.
That's true. So that's also a restriction of farmers' rights, which is unbelievable. The whole thing with canola at the University of Manitoba is a very sad situation as far as I'm concerned. There was a lot of controversy when Monsanto approached the University of Manitoba to grow their seeds. A whole lot of controversy, and a lot of people were opposed to it. But what happened in the long term, the university needed money, and they capitulated. And they now have Monsanto is placed right beside the University of Manitoba. And I remember years ago, a few of us had protested in front of their gardens, and you know, we were trying to get the message across, but nobody really understood what the whole issue was, you know, in terms of seeds. So here we left. So I do not ever since then, do not buy canola oil. I use different types of oils, olive oil, grapeseed oil, and different types of oil, but I will not use canola because it is genetically modified. Having said that, okay.
And to plug, you mentioned Daruk's Top of the Hill Farm. They are one of the few places in Manitoba you can get sunflower seed oil that is organic and pressed and extracted right here in Manitoba.
Well, thanks for mentioning that. That's good to know. And they're wonderful people. They deliver to our school because they deliver to businesses. And so we're considered that, so we're able to take advantage of that. And they also deliver to Organic Planet and different places in Winnipeg. They're very very amazing people.
very much so.
Are there any myths concerning organic food? I'm thinking that some people claim that organic foods are too expensive or that organic farmers are exploiting the consumer, things like that. Do you want to comment especially on why some people find the cost of organic foods to be so prohibitive?
Definitely. I think one common misconception is that twofold, organic is fake. It doesn't actually mean anything. Which I think we've already talked about thoroughly is how much goes into what it means to be organic. And the other one I hear a lot is that farmers are just trying to overcharge consumers. It's not. They're the ones getting the bump on this price, and that's not reality. Organic products often do have slightly higher costs, and that's not just because of the certification and all of those steps we had talked about earlier in the value chain that have to be inspected. Those come at a labor cost. Someone has to go and do those inspections. And overall, that adds a little bit of cost to the product. But also organic farming as a whole, because you're trying to farm with healthy soil and healthy ecosystems, there's more labor in those farms. So by prioritizing soil health and animal welfare over the shortcuts that could be taken, it involves increased labor on those farms. So one of the examples I really like to share with people is when I was a kid, we had two farms that we ran as a family, and I was still young and just helping out here and there. And one was a conventional system, a one-section farm, and one was an organic system. And we ran both farms simultaneously and found that the organic farm was actually making the same profit for us every year. We weren't making any more money on the organic farm, but we weren't making less. And that, for my dad as the decision maker at the time, was enough for him to say, I don't want to be using these inputs on our farm. I don't want the exposure for my children. I would like to just farm organically. So organic farmers are not making more because of the way they choose to farm, but often are getting compensated so that the more labor intensive and the slightly lower yield is still going to be livable for them as a farmer.
Well, that's...
I think it's also... Yep. I guess the other one I try and I, for me, even as a consumer, if I'm going to the store, is the true cost of food includes its impact on the environment and health. And organic food incorporates that cost.
Mm-hmm. And of course, I'm sure organic foods has a good impact on our health, whereas the other foods we're ingesting, when we're getting the non-organic foods, we're ingesting this glyphosate and in all its forms. And it's a no-brainer, you know? So it's a corporate takeover. That's all that I can say about it. And I think you have explained that there is traceability in organic farming, that the certification provides that ability to have traceability for the products, that it can be ascertained that your things that you're growing are organic.
Yes.
Are you familiar with Janine Gibson?
Very much so. I've known Janine since I was a little girl.
Oh, yeah. She has an organic farm. She's also, I believe, she's an inspector.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The first time I met Janine, and she was actually the random inspector that was chosen to come to our farm one year. So, she came, and I remember we were canning and stayed at the farm. And getting to talk and drink tea and engage with someone that knew organic on a scale that was so much bigger than at that time what my reality was, which was just our little farm.
Mm-hmm.
Mind if I ask a question?
Yes, certainly. Go ahead, John.
I actually have a question for you right now, too. Would your farm be monoculture or permaculture?
I think, John, that's a very complicated question. I wish I could just give you a black and white answer because it's a mix of both. We are a cereal farm, so we're doing organic grains, and there have been years where we have been a monoculture. We have grown what is a clean wheat field with, this year one of our fields was just rye. And that is an example of a monoculture. It is often the most profitable, is we have one crop growing, we don't have to clean it, it can grow really well. That being said, when we are trying to farm, I'm trying to farm as sustainable as we can and balancing that with profitability. So a lot of our fields are in a permaculture-based system, and we do that through incorporating things like nurse crops. So under our wheat, we had a red clover seeded. So that way, there was always two things growing this summer. And when we harvested that wheat just 2 weeks ago, that red clover is underneath. So now that the wheat's gone, it can thrive and it can grow a little bit taller and it can stay there over the winter and protect the soil and grow some nitrogen for next year's crop and give a habitat for birds and wildlife and other things that now have some greenery and fodder to live in so that we don't have any bare ground. We also have a quarter section that we've taken out of crop production and put into pasture that is now a diversified pasture. And we're seeing some native species like sunflowers come back into that land, which is beautiful to see. And having cows on that land is helping us restore what is a permaculture-based system and can eventually start integrating things like using those cows to graze the red clover instead of tillage, which is what we're going to need to do in our current operation, to try and close the loop on fertility so that everything can be as close to a circle system where what the cows are eating is being digested and adding bacteria from their guts and then going back on the soil, that it can give that soil a little jump start of bacteria to help the microorganisms in the soil also break down this organic matter and make it even healthier for next year's crop that ideally will keep doing these nurse crops or even polycrops. So putting things like peas and oats together in the same field and then cleaning the seed and separating them into two crops at the end.
Because certain legumes provide a lot of nitrogen into the
legumes,
soil. Yeah.
Yeah. They're critical in organic cropping because we are not using synthetic nitrogen, which is a natural gas-based product. We're growing our nitrogen. So a legume is a keystone of an organic farm because that's how we get fertility for the crops that we export.
Mm-hmm. The website refers to permitted substance lists that can be used in organic farming and the production of organic products. And this is called the Organic Standards and Permitted Standard List. Do you want to explain that?
Yeah, so the CORE, the Canadian Organic Regime, or the standard, uses the permitted substance list is what you're allowed to use and under what conditions in organic farming, rather than saying what we're not allowed to use. So I think a lot of times when we talk about organic, we talk about what it's not. We're not using glyphosate. We're not using these herbicides. But a lot of organic is what are we doing, which is caring for the soil, supporting soil health, environmental protection, not just crop yield. And when you are building these systems, we say, okay, what are you allowed to use? So an example would be like composted manure is on the permitted substance list. We can use composted animal manure as a way of bringing fertility in. If it's not on that permitted substance list, you're not allowed to use it in your fields.
Okay. Well, that makes a lot of sense. Like, manure has always been a good addition to farmland. Dr. Meg Sears, she's from the organization titled Prevent Cancer Now. She reported that hormone-related cancers such as breast and testicular cancers are increasing at younger ages, probably related to hormone mimicking plastics, pesticides, and other substances. There is also an intergenerational effect from exposure from previous generations, such as grandmothers, etc. Do you see that this is a kind of a situation that we may not even be aware of, that we are... that the increase in cancer could be related to our exposure to all these different things that are being used in the environment?
Yeah, it's a big one. Research continues to show there's a connection between synthetic chemical exposure and health impacts, including hormone disruption. That seems to be the biggest one. And pesticides and PFAS or plastics can mimic these hormones, and we see that in autoimmune disorders. One of the issues with glyphosate and how difficult these court cases has been is that a lot of the health repercussions are not direct. We're not seeing immediate reactions. Like you said, we're seeing these intergenerational and longstanding. And the latest theory on glyphosate and some of the farmers that have had, unfortunately, cancer relating to their high exposure is being tracked down to the fact that the theory is that it's not hurting us directly, but it's killing the guts, our guts. It's killing the bacteria in our guts. It's doing what it's supposed to do as a herbicide, which is to kill things. And in doing so, it's leaving us really vulnerable to imbalances, and that is what is leading to cancer. And again, it's really hard when we get to these indirect secondary impacts to have really hard science and be able to say, yes, this dose, this amount is what is causing this reaction. And because of that, it's why it's really hard to lobby for human health when we talk about conventional agriculture and these inputs. So I really like to advocate that organic farming does reduce your exposure by design. We don't use them. And it's not only about the food we eat, but in Manitoba, it is in our air, our water, and our ecosystems that surround us. So by supporting an organic farm, by buying organic, you're not just choosing to buy food that's reducing your potential exposure, but you are reducing your exposure by supporting a farm that reduces the use in your province. And I think that is where we're seeing a lot of exposure is not just in our food, but it's in our water systems right now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's very good to be aware of this, the whole picture. And it's very disconcerting, but there's no doubt about it that cancer has become much, much more prevalent. In my grandmother's time, that's going a long way back, it was hardly known. It was a very rare kind of disease. And now it's just as common as having as a flu or something. It is so, so common that people have just grown used to it. They think, well, they can get treatment and so on. But Anyway, as we're moving along here, we're getting maybe running out of time a little bit. Could you just tell us about the organic certification according to the organic standard and why? I think you might have covered that, eh? But did you want to, why it is necessary to have certification?
Yeah, that label, that sticker, the certification protects both our farmer and our consumer. So it ensures fairness by holding everyone to the same national rules. And it can give consumers confidence that organic actually means something. There's a lot of weight behind this. Without that certification, anyone can make the claim. You can say you're organic, but that erodes some trust in the system. And having that seal and its standards and all the weight behind it is what can give you something to trust. It also is a really big conversation when we talk about international trade, because it provides consistency across Canada for international trades where we have equivalencies with several countries that we can export our product. And there's things like oranges we're not going to be growing in Canada. And that way we can still guarantee that they're up to the same standard that we want them.
Okay. And could you tell us about the terminology applying to organically grown food, such as Canadian Organic Standard and the Canadian Organic Regulation? Could you explain what the differences between those two?
Yeah, so I often talk about the CORE, the Canadian Organic Regulation, and that is the standard enforceable under law. This is a federal regulation. So this is part of our federal laws, what that means. The organic standard is how we describe the food that's under the regulation. So together, it's just the language we use to talk about what is law and what the standards are to meet that law. The logo will mean the same thing if you're in Manitoba or in British Columbia because of that federal law.
Okay. And people who wish to grow their gardens, for example, organically are also providing healthy foods for themselves, but they won't be able to market the foods as such. I don't know. The farmers markets that we have that come to the city, I'm assuming that most of them are organic. I'm not sure if they have the certification, but do you want to comment on farmers markets? And it's such a pleasure being able to buy straight from the farmers.
Very much so. So yeah, I guess two facets. Growing organically at home is a great way to connect with your food and soil, and the intricacy of trying to balance that system. You can't just buy a jug of fertilizer and say, okay, we're done. You are working long-term to have a closed loop system. And they contribute to biodiversity and food security. And I am a huge advocate for backyard gardens. And then farmers markets is complicated. Some producers are certified in Manitoba and I really applaud them, but many aren't, and they might still follow organic practices. So this is especially prevalent in Manitoba, where you get to meet your farmer. You can talk to them. You could go to their farm and see how they're farming and make sure that it is aligning with your values. The best thing a consumer can do is talk to their farmer if they're buying. When we have organic certifications, I like to say that sticker tells your story. So if you're buying in a supermarket, you don't get to talk to that farmer. And when you see the organic certification, you know that there's a certain weight behind it, that tells that farmer's story for them and how they're choosing to farm. At a farmer's market, you can ask a farmer how they're farming, and you might be able to get that story without needing that certification. And several farms still choose to certify because they want to be able to tell their consumers, I've been inspected. I've met all these standards and I can prove it. And that is the one issue, is occasionally we do have cases where people claim to be organic and are not inspected and are not actually organic. I think that is the anomaly. Most often, if you ask a farmer, they will say, and commonly, that they do use fertilizer. A lot of farmers are still using synthetic fertilizer because it is hard to balance the system without it, but are not using any fungicides or herbicides or insecticides. They're spray free rather than organic. And you can ask a farmer specifically what they're using and if they're meeting the organic standard. And most farmers will be honest with you and tell you if they are, or if there's a few places where they're not and why.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Marika, for joining us this morning. I apologize for mentioning Kaelin Spain. I was getting, for some reason, I'm having Kaelin Spain and Marianne Sorelli as guests in the next few weeks. And somehow, I just lost my...
That's okay.
Yeah, I think
we do a lot of work with young agrarians and Kaelin, so I'm a little sad. I love getting to talk with her, but she'll be a great interview.
I think they're coming on the 24th, is my understanding.
Yes. But it was a pleasure talking to you, Marika, and you provided us with a lot of very good information, and you're very knowledgeable, and I appreciate your taking the time to join us this morning. Yeah, so
thanks,
do you
Regine.
Happen to have a song that you would like to have us play, or
ooh,
maybe John will find one?
Question.
He's usually good at picking.
Can we play Hall & Oates, You Make My Dreams Come True?
Okay.
That is when I was in university, and in times of stress has always been one of my songs to be a little uplifting and to look on the brighter side of life. And to make our dreams come true and what we want for the world. So it's always been a favorite.
Here we go. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, Mary Jane. And thanks for asking the questions.
What I want.
You're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM. Time is 8:48. Temperature outside is -1.
Okay, and we're listening to Wooden Spoons. I'm just going to have some time left to talk about the importance of nature, native plants, as opposed to cultivars introduced as our into our lawns and landscapes, which do not support insect life and do not support the environment. A New York Times bestseller, Nature's Best Hope, offers a new approach to conservation that starts in your own yard. This book is written by Douglas Ptolemy, and he refers to another scientist, I think you could call him E.O. Wilson, who called insects, in quote, the little thing that runs the world due to all the essential ecological roles they play every day. Insects pollinate 87.5% of all plants and 90% of all flowering plants, which in turn which turn the energy from the sun into the food that birds, mammals, reptiles, amphibians, freshwater fish need to live. Doug Ptolemy asserts that humans would last only a few months if insects were to disappear from the earth. Since 1974, insects have been reduced by 45% globally. Nearly all insects are harmless and beneficial. We should learn to appreciate them instead of killing them. Like Ptolemy, local botanist Laura Reeves recommends planting native species to encourage insect life, to feed larvae, caterpillars, and pollinators, and to encourage biodiversity. She noted that most nurseries sell cultivars of native plants, which means that they are plants that are selected, bred, or hybridized for traits that are attractive to humans, which translates into larger flowers, longer bloom times, different colored leaves, doubled flowers, etc. But these traits are often unattractive to insects. Research has shown that after these enhanced traits, often come at the expense of nectar and or pollen production, or make the plants less or not attractive to insects. She points out that a clue to knowing that a plant is a cultivar or not is its name. Plant species have two scientific names. When the second scientific name is replaced by an English name, it is a cultivar. So a cultivar, that's a terminology that means that it's not in its natural form and it has been modified. So there's to get a list of native plant nurseries in Manitoba, you can go to the website mgmanitoba.com. Now, Doug Ptolemy and Laura Reeves are saying the same things when they say that the best thing to do is to do nothing at all. The key is to do less, not mowing your lawn that often, not raking up the leaves and throwing them into the garbage, not cleaning up on the dead or rotten logs. I happen to have some rotten logs in our yard, and I find them very fascinating, and they're slowly, slowly deteriorating. And it's enriching the soil, too. It seems that the less we do, the more we are protecting biodiversity. The manicured lawn should not be the goal. And so in our society, we seem to have, there seems to be an addiction to having this manicured lawn, all clean and tidy, no weeds allowed sort of thing. But weeds should be recognized as for what they are. They are strong, they are survivors, and some weeds are very edible. Like pigweed, for instance, growing in your garden, you can also eat them. And I have done so. They're sort of like a spinach. So our addiction to this idea of the manicured lawn is really not with it. It is not in our best interests, and it's not in the interests of the insects on which we depend. And I have seen very few insects this year, very few butterflies. I have milkweed, but there are no butterflies. I do believe it has a lot to do with the smoke that we were afflicted with from all the fires. That must have had an impact. But there are very few insects and no mosquitoes. My daughter and I were coming from the country several weeks ago after picking raspberries at my sister's farm, and she commented. She said, where there's nothing hitting the windshields, when normally when you're driving, there's all kinds of insects that hit the windshields. No insects around. So that is very worrisome. So I think we have to start changing our value system and living according to, in a more natural way, respecting nature, because without nature, we will not survive. I have a brief recipe from a book called Healing with Whole Foods, and it comes from another a book called Oriental Traditions and Modern Nutrition by Paul Pitchford. And under the title of Healing with Whole Foods, here is a barley loaf with lentils. It's very simple to make, and it's very nutritious. All you have to do is take 1 cup of barley, which is soaked to soften it, and 1/2 cup of red lentils, which have also been soaked and, of course, drained. And you take 4.5 cups of water and 1/4 teaspoon of sea salt. Sea salt has more nutrition than the table salt. Table salt is devitalized. It has iodine in it. That's about it. But if you get the sea salt or rock salt, you have a whole array of nutrients. That makes it a whole food, unlike salt, which is related to increased blood pressure. And that is not true for the sea salt or Himalayan rock salt. So you put all these things, you place all the ingredients. It calls for some sea salt and a bay leaf and parsley. You preheat the oven to 350 degrees Fahrenheit. You place all the ingredients in a pot except the parsley and bring to a boil. Reduce the heat, then you simmer for 2 minutes. Pour the mixture into a greased loaf pan. Cover and bake for 1 hour. And you serve in slices with parsley on top. And you might want to add a sauce or something. I've never tried this recipe, but it's certainly something I will be trying, and it's certainly very wholesome. And this concludes our program for Wooden Spoons this morning. It went by very quickly, and Mary Ann Sorelli and Kaelin Spain will be taking the program on the 24th, as I've been explaining over the past few weeks. And this will be an interesting sharing of programming. So thank you for listening. I want to thank our guests for joining us this morning, for Marika joining us. Thank you, John, for being our co-host.
Yeah, anytime. You've been listening to Wooden Spoons, sponsored by Mary Jane's Cooking School on CKUW 95.9 FM. For our podcast, please go to ckuw.ca, type Wooden Spoons in the search bar, and the show will be up in just a few hours. Till next time, this is John Dick and Mary Jane Eason saying bye for now, and thanks for listening.